Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Venture with me, Arish Shah. Today on the podcast with me in the studio, I have Jan Reichelt. Jan is founding and general partner of 10x Founders, a network-driven investor backed by over 200 entrepreneurs and angels. In today's episode, we talk about education and edtech being immediately global.
And the beautiful thing about this industry is that it's immediately global. It's immediately English-speaking. It's kind of, you know, a pretty big common standard that runs across all of it.
How, if you can create value and people are prepared to pay, there will always be a route to exit. How sometimes listening to too much external advice as a founder can be counterproductive. Be confident in yourself as a founder. And how windows of opportunity led to Jan selling his second business. How you can't scale investing as an angel, and why Europe needs more investors with founder backgrounds.
I still feel that Europe needs more founder, like investors who have been founders before.
How entrepreneurship wasn't a job for Jan, it was his life. So he designed it to ensure he had the balance he was looking for. And Jan's contrarian piece of advice, you shouldn't only have to talk to partners at a VC fund. Let's get into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I have Jan Reichelt, an entrepreneur at heart. Jan has spent his career in technology startups, online businesses, professional information services, and digital media. Jan is now a founding and general partner of 10x Founders, a network-driven investor backed by over 200 entrepreneurs and angels. Previously, he founded the scientific collaboration platform Mendeley, acquired by RELX, Elsevier PLC, and Copernio, a Spotify for research papers, acquired by Clarivate PLC. At Clarivate, Jan was managing director for Web of Science, responsible for revenues of over $250 million. In 2013, he was named European Founder of the Year, 2013, by TechCrunch and the Europas. Jan, welcome to the studio. Really wonderful to have you here with me.
Thank you for having me.
Amazing. Let's dive straight in. So I have a bit of an interest, I think a very large interest, in all things education, obviously with two kids, and also having spent a fairly large proportion of my kind of tech career with an ed tech. I'd love to have a bit of a conversation around where you see the future of education and ed tech, having founded and exited businesses in this space. And I guess appropriately, you know, we've just seen videos of the launch of GPT-4o, which looks like, you know, there is some incredible opportunities in that kind of tutoring AI space. So yeah, I'd love to get your take on where we're heading.
Oh yeah, well, ed tech is really a space dear to my heart, but it's also a very difficult space, I think. And I think you have to look at it. It's very difficult to say there is ed tech, because I think you have to look at it from different perspectives. The space I was in was always higher education, like scientific and academic research. And the beautiful thing about this industry is that it's immediately global. It's immediately English speaking. It's kind of, you know, a pretty big common standard that runs across all of it. If you go below that, let's say in terms of you know, experience or levels, then you're in K-12, for example, and then in schools, and then it becomes, I would say, a little bit more difficult, because suddenly you have very fragmented, regulated markets. You know, you have kind of the mixture between parents, the kids, the schools.
Who are you selling to? You've got to do multi-level marketing, exactly, to get to the economic buyer.
Yeah. Exactly. And you already have that actually in higher education and science, right? You have the researcher, and then you have the publisher producing some content and selling content, and the institution buying the content. So you have that, but not to that extreme as it is maybe at the level of the schools. And that makes it quite challenging and difficult. But yet at the same time, you know, we've all lived through COVID. It just has shown us how important this space is and how much we need to think about it. And luckily, there are new technologies coming out, you know, every year, every couple of years, that will provide a boost for that industry, such as what you just said, which I think will absolutely have an impact on tutoring. Historically, you have like normal tutor marketplaces, I'd say, in that particular case. And I can see that being revolutionized indeed by just conversational AI, so to say, where you can do your, you have your customized tutor basically just online. Yeah, and then you need to just, as you already said, you need to figure out, you know, who's your user in that space and who's your customer and who else do you need to get on board, like the teacher, for example. Another thing you have to consider is obviously when it's about kids is the aspect of privacy.
Yeah.
It's also a challenging thing. And then the business model, right? If you sell B2C, then obviously the immediate question that one would ask yourself from an investor perspective is kind of how big can this get? It doesn't need to be the question immediately for the founder, because if the founder has a passion, then they will just go anyway.
And often with EdTech, you tend to find that founders come from that background, yes, have a very, very significant desire to make a difference. It's not necessarily just about the commercials, although obviously that's important. But yeah, it is that sort of, we want to revolutionize education rather than we want to make a ton of money.
Yes, I think that is very, and it's very good, because people are really trying to solve the problem and they are motivated by trying to solve the problem. And the money is so to say, the second criteria potentially. But what we've seen, or what I've seen is, and what I find really interesting is, probably you're familiar with Toniebox, mm-hmm, and there's a new startup called EduReno. The way how they are, I must say, almost circumventing that problem of figuring out how to sell, who's your customer, and all these kinds of regulation things, is that they're actually developing a toy. Mm-hmm. And so they're not on the level of, you know, I'm providing software or, you know, something that's privacy intruding or something like this. You know, it's a toy. And at the same time, you can consider it clearly as ed tech. So I find these approaches quite interesting, because, you know, you immediately get rid of a lot of problems for growth.
Yeah.
And still have the opportunity to have great impact.
Well, you're essentially selling a consumer product at that stage. You don't have to, exactly as you said, you don't have to worry about the regulations as much. I'm sure there is some of that, but essentially your targeting and your marketing can be much, much more streamlined, and the playbook for selling toys and consumer products is well fleshed out by now, right? So it's a lot easier to kind of, use that. I mean, one question I did have for you, you know, you've exited two businesses in this space. We don't really see a lot of ed tech exits, or certainly not large ones, and certainly not well publicized ones, right? Like there are, you know, there are companies you mentioned, you know, the kind of tutor marketplaces. So, you know, there's one in the UK, mytutor.co.uk, you know, which has swallowed up some of the smaller marketplaces that are out there. But one, I struggle to see what is the exit route for a business like that, right? It doesn't feel like it's sort of business like IPO, doesn't necessarily feel like there is an acquirer that makes sense for that. And then if you look at, you know, all the MOOCs in the US, you know, they all came up against that sort of question. Okay, where does this go, and where does the liquidity come from? So, like, how do you think about that? Like, how does that work? And I guess to an extent, how did you find those exits in the two businesses that you built?
Well, I guess from a founder perspective, my view would be, well, if you are able to create value and people are prepared to pay, then eventually there will be a route to exit, right? Creating liquidity. But the point is, you know, focus on solving the problem and then creating value, so to say. And if you are able to do that, then eventually there will be an exit route. in my particular space, as I said, like higher ed or academic research, it was more about the big publishing companies in this particular case, because there's a lot of academic content that's being published and data around that academic content. And my field was always in that space. And so
there was the likes of Macmillan and HarperCollins or whoever. Yeah,
exactly. And I think many of those companies, they have a heritage and a history being a publisher, which has historically been a very offline kind of activity.
Yeah.
And so I know that, of course, many of those companies have made moves to digitize their business, build digital products. Some still have not, or they still struggle. But I do think this would be also one way. And I mean, in my case, it happened twice, that you have like these companies that are either publishers or data providers in that space that need better digital products, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Elsevier previously didn't have a lot of digital, let's say, product development. And the idea there was also to reinforce their team with a team like Mendeley. And that worked really beautifully together. So I think that would be another consideration that I would tell someone who's
trying to do something or invest in that space, that these might be candidates that are looking for innovation.
Yeah, I mean, definitely agree with that. I think the publishers have all tried to breach that sort of digital landscape, but mostly, I would say, have been unsuccessful. I mean, I don't know all of them, but the big names certainly don't seem to have done massively well in that regard. So to an extent, I guess, you know, what you're saying is, if you can build a great product and have a great team, then you can almost get acqui-hired, but with liquidity, right? So you know, they're buying the product, but more than anything else, they're also buying the team and the expertise.
Yeah, what I would also find interesting is, like, you know, if you had someone who had the ambition to say, you know, actually, why can't we become one of the market leaders and eventually complement our digital offering with more content and we buy a publisher?
Yes. Interesting.
So thinking it the other way around, right? Yeah. I mean, yes, I get it. Obviously, you know, as an entrepreneur, at some point you want to think about, you know, how, also as an investor, you know, where could be routes to liquidity. But I could see it also turning around that, yes, content is super important, but we know that the that digital products have such an incredible impact, for better or worse, that eventually, if you build just a very sticky digital product, you know, why not think it the other way around, that you then hoover up some publishers to supplant your, so to say, digital product with relevant content?
Yeah, and look, absolutely, I guess, from my experience in the space, content building is incredibly expensive because it is human-led, notwithstanding, obviously, you know, as we discussed, whatever's going on with GPT and so on and LLMs. But, you know, for the most part, you had, you know, curriculum designers, and you had content creators, and you had, obviously, designers, you had animators, all this sort of stuff to be able to, you know, come up with, I don't know, one module's worth of content. And of course, then you've got to do it again and again, and then you've got to refresh the content and add new content. And that just becomes an ever increasing kind of hole of cost. Like, it's very, you know, at one point, I guess, with tech development, and obviously there's always ongoing tech, cost for engineering, but at a certain point, the product can just go. The content, on the other hand, needs to be constantly renewed and refreshed. Apart from anything else, people also get bored, right? So their expectation is that there's always going to be something new. So I really like that idea of actually, yes, okay, if you acquire the publisher, that's a backdoor, A, to the content. So you suddenly buy a library. So it's like Netflix buying a library of films or whatever. Yeah. You buy your library of content. And actually at that stage, there's probably more ability to seek an exit route, because now you have a combined entity where you have several moats, right? You have a technological technological moat, you have the content moat, and then you know, and then you can potentially find, you know, either buyers or go for a listing.
Yeah. What I think super exciting in this space is, if you really think about combining content with technology, I think beautiful things can happen, because obviously each digital product and the quality of a digital product depends and can be significantly improved with better data that underlies the digital product. And that can be, obviously, you know, just user and interaction data. But I'm also thinking about content. And so if there were more models, you know, where we could combine digital products with relevant content, I think, you know, those products can just be massively better than and more impactful than before.
Amazing. I think one final question on this, I guess, before we move on and talk about 10x Founders. So, you know, two exits in this space. You know, a lot of founders are very lucky to have the one. So two is, you know, you're batting above the averages, probably. Lessons learned, things you'd have done differently. And, you know, were those exits opportunistic to an extent? Or did you strategically know that, okay, this was the end point that we were aiming for?
So I'd say lessons learned, what I would have done differently. I think there's one thing that stuck to my mind is, you know, I probably could have been a bit more, even more confident in the journey of being a founder. Sometimes when you're an unexperienced founder, I mean, that was certainly the case in my first venture, Mendeley, you try to talk to lots of experienced people and try to listen to their advice. And I think potentially we've listened a bit too much to external advice rather than listening to your gut feeling. And the reason is because there's so much data out there and you need to make up your mind, but only you really see all these clouds around yourself and can make the most of it, and no external advisor can. So you're trying to seek for the answer being provided maybe by somebody else, whilst actually you should just go on with your gut feeling. So this confidence, I would say to other founders, you know, retain your confidence, it will be okay. And then the exits in terms of, why did we exit? there's one concept that I learned. Actually, I did have an entrepreneurship class at my university, and this concept was called window of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And it's not just relating to the exit; it's, you know, regarding to fundraising, to many, you know, hiring, many other aspects of building a company. And sometimes there are these windows of opportunity where you don't know if it's the right thing or not, but it's an opportunity that you have to consider. And in particular, with the second company that I built, Copernio, you know, when Clarivate said, you know, we really think this technology is amazing and we want to combine it with our most important product, which is Web of Science, which is the global gold standard in academic research. I mean, come on, you know, it's like if Real Madrid comes to you and say, you know, you want to be our forward, you're not going to say no, no?
Even if it wasn't necessarily the point at which you thought you were going to exit.
It was not the plan.
The opportunity is...
No, exactly. It was not the plan. And to this day, Copernio, which since then has rebranded to EndNote Click, is one of the top 10 most downloaded Chrome plugins in the Chrome store. So I think in terms of impact and the scalability that this provided to the product and getting more people more access to research was just the right decision. So in this case, again, it was an opportunity that came up. We would have been stupid to ignore it. And yeah, who knows what would have been the outcome had we decided otherwise. But yeah, I have absolutely no regrets. I think it's the right thing. And people still to this day talk to me about the products. And that's great from a founder perspective.
I mean, yeah, like the legacy that you want to leave in the world is, you know, that your product exists, it thrives, and people are using it and getting value out of it. And I think, you know, whether that exit happened a year earlier or 5 years earlier even than you expected, I think that's the sort of legacy that any founder would want to have. So look, let's move on to 10x Founders. So can you talk to me about the genesis of the fund, which ultimately culminated in you raising 160 million euros from over 200 LPs, especially ex-entrepreneurs? It'd be also really good to get your impressions on the benefits of having been a founder operator to moving into VC. In a relatively recent post on LinkedIn, you dived into the data and you noted that founder VCs with successful exits seem to have a higher investment success rate, 29.8%, than non-founder professional VCs, 23.2%, or founder VCs without successful exits, 19.2%. So what do you think drives this data? So essentially, I guess what you're saying at the top of the tree is exited founder turned VC, then it is traditional sort of finance VCs, I guess, and then thereafter operators without a successful exit that turned VC. And also, I think wrapping this all up even further, to talk also about the opportunity within Europe and European tech, and I'm currently I just wrote in my newsletter today about Andreas Klinger's kind of EU ACC movement, where he's trying to, you know, at least fix a couple of immediate things around a European, you know, a standard European entity, so an EU Inc. And then his second one being, you know, just can everyone just learn English? As a linguist, I'm like, okay, I get it, but okay. But yeah, no, it'd be great. So the genesis of 10x, founder operator VC versus a sort of traditional model, and then kind of, I guess, where you see Europe going.
Yep, okay, cool. Well, the genesis really was after my second exit, I had started angel investing and I liked it a lot because I liked the interaction with founders. Yeah, I can really connect. It's the thrill. It's like, I can feel your pain. I can feel your joy. It's really cool. But as an angel, you're just like, it's a one-man show, one-person show. It's like, you're not, you know, it's not really that engaging. And I like to build things and build things together with great people. And that led me then to reconnect to some of, the people that are involved with 10x Founders now as well, who all felt similar, all former entrepreneurs, and who were on a similar journey. And so we said, like, wow, if we were putting our energy together, we could do a lot more on a European level. And I told you earlier that part of my motivation was also that I still feel that Europe needs more founder, like investors who have been founders before. I think, you know, having more of those people in the ecosystem will be beneficial to the founders. And so, yeah, here we go. We then were very pragmatic. You know, we had lots of people who showed an interest in co-investing with us, given, let's say, obviously our track record. And so we went to them, said, okay, fine, this is the plan. Would you support us? Would you invest? And here we go. And we raised fairly quickly within a year, 160 million euro fund.
I mean, that's very quick. I mean, at the moment, you know, small funds, 30 million are taking 3 years to...
I mean, admittedly, this was in 2021 where times were really, really good. But it was nevertheless quick. And it just showed us that there were many people understanding what we wanted to do and were supportive of that mission. And so... Yeah, and so now we're like 3 years in, and it works amazingly well, I would say. I love it, and I think the interactions with the founders is great, and we get to get to back fantastic companies. So that's the genesis of 10x Founders. And then obviously, as part of this, now that for me it was a new role also. I had never, as I said earlier, never done, investing at that professional level. And so it was pushing the boundaries for me. It was a great learning curve and still is. But then obviously the question is like, okay, does the fact that you have been a, founder, successful, unsuccessful, that you've been a founder, does this qualify you to be a good investor? Because quite frankly, it's to some extent a different role, right?
They're different skill sets, for sure.
You could say, it's asset allocation, different words that you could use to describe what you're doing there.
Because, essentially, sorry to interrupt, as a founder, you have to be in the weeds, understanding the day-to-day. Today, have we made payroll? What's
building
broken?
Stuff.
What is, is the product, what sort of...
Listening to the customer.
Yeah, what are the outstanding open tickets that we got? Whereas as an investor, you got to take yourself way, way above that and think about, okay, what does this business look like in 10 years? Yeah. Is it worth making an investment today? Irrespective of what the operational issues might be today.
Exactly, right? Yes. Yeah. And so, in that light, I've then asked myself the question, okay, does the fact that I've been a founder before qualify me in any particular way more or equally so to be an investor? And so I did a little bit of research. Now, I must say it wasn't like super academic research that I did, but, there were some data points that made me confident that to be able to say, yeah, the fact that I had been a founder before, and in my case, luckily twice successful, probably has a positive influence on my activities as an investor. And some of them are more tangible than others. The less tangible ones are probably that I just, really can connect to founders because I can just see.
You understand the team and
yeah,
their personalities.
Yeah, I just understand what they're up to. And, and when you scale from whatever, 10 to 20 people, it starts to hurt for the first time because you need to introduce hierarchies and all this stuff, right? And then on the more tangible side, there was this research which I then put together in a LinkedIn blog post, which actually showed there was a research paper. It was not peer reviewed. It was not, it's not like super safe or super.
Is anything in venture ever peer reviewed? Yeah. I'm not sure that it is.
Exactly. Yeah. But there was some indication that says, okay, if there is a founder who had successful exit previously, that their investment success rate indeed on average seems to be higher. And then the paper also says why that might be the case, not necessarily.
So sorry to interrupt again. This is one of the other problems in venture when you start talking about averages.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Like, so the question is, does the founder investor have, as a percentile, is it in the top percentile of hits?
Yeah.
Or is it just across the average it has better success?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And I honestly, I couldn't tell. And
of course.
But it was just an interesting thought experiment and interesting conversation that we also had internally. And in fact, also the measurement, like why were these founder investors more quote unquote successful, was not really because they were able to better identify an investment opportunity. But it seems, and again, it's just some data points and not like super conclusive, but it seems that the main reason is because founder investors are able to add apparently more value post-investment.
Got it.
And here the circle closes, right? Why is this? Well, because they maybe can associate better with the situation that the founder is in and say, maybe they have a very good network because they were founders themselves, so they know the right people that you need in different stages of the company. So it was, again, an interesting thought experiment. From a founder's perspective, I would anyway say, it's good to have a couple of different types of investors around the table, not just one type of investor.
Sure.
So, that was. I'm sure if I read more about this stuff, I will do another blog post. But it was an interesting exercise.
I think just before we carry on, I guess the other, just to close that loop as well, the other point there is, over the last 5-6 years, maybe that operating experience hasn't been as, I wouldn't say relevant. It's always been relevant, but founders. They had capital on tap, right? Like if you had a problem, raise more cash, solve the problem by throwing money at it. Today, when there are actual problems in businesses that, investors are not being as open with their purse strings, but B, founders are needing to be more capital efficient and understand how to manage that cash way better. Actually having someone around the table who's been there, done that can give you, real life experience. And again, to your earlier point, around advisors, you shouldn't always take what an advisor tells you as read because, there is a lot of anecdotal evidence out there that, even being an exited founder, no one ever talks about the amount of luck that played a part in getting to that exit. And I'm not belittling any exit founders. By any stretch of the imagination, you know, it's an incredible achievement, however you get there. But the problem is always, you know, does your experience in this business map directly onto another founder's experience in their business?
Yeah, I think the resulting risk from that is also, if you look at typical founder characters and personalities, is that usually they have, I guess, the tendency to want to be right.
Yeah.
You know, I've been there, I've done that, I know how it works. Yeah. And so there's obviously also a risk of getting maybe over-involved and trying to tell the founder how they should run their business. And again, this is also something that we're discussing at 10x Founders very proactively. And we say, no, you know, we make very, very clear that you as the founder, you run the business. Like, we cannot run the business for you, and we will not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this is, I guess, what you then, when you move to the investor side, you need to learn to get the distance. And be able to leave, you know, the final, the ultimate decision power with the founder.
Yeah, and that, I think that is, it's a really fine line to walk, because on the one hand, founders, especially younger founders, are looking for that guidance, right? And then sometimes will feel shortchanged if an investor isn't able to guide them. But then equally, to exactly to your point, no founder anywhere wants to be told, well, this is the direction you must take. Now, obviously, yes, your board, if you have a good board, and I've seen lots of bad boards, but if you have a good board, your board will give you direction and they will validate your thinking, but they will validate the decision you make, not make the decision for you. I think that is the point. Now, they will challenge a bad decision or what they perceive to be a bad decision, but ultimately running the business comes down to you as the founder. So I think that's exactly the right kind of way to look at it and the approach to take. And I guess, given that you are in Germany and are your other kind of partners at 10x also Europe-wide, or are they sort of more concentrated particular geography?
We have our office, our base, so to say, in Munich, but we invest everywhere across Europe. I mean, in the times of like post-COVID, Zoom, you know, it's not a problem to do any, you know, interviews or due diligence or discussions, meetings with founders online. And then, yeah, obviously we also do travel, you know, either to conferences or we visit the different cities to meet the founders. So I think it's kind of a hybrid world that we also employ at 10x Founders. Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason I ask is, as I mentioned, you know, I've been tracking what Andreas Klinger from Remote First Capital is doing with this EU-AC kind of movement, which, you know, is associated with the EAC movement, which, you know, was promoted by various people, including Mark Andreessen. But, you know, the interesting thing there is he's taken the moniker. I think he's taken the kind of the notion of the name or what the name conjures up, but he's really applied it in the European context. And, you know, one of the memes that goes around a lot is, like, you know, angels and investors for that matter often say, well, you know, once they figure out a company is, you know, incorporated in Germany, like, the friction of getting a round done, you know, becomes huge. Notaries, you have to fly out, wet signatures, you know, all this sort of stuff. I guess two questions. Where do you see Europe going, positively or negatively? And do you think kind of an overarching startup ecosystem, a more cohesive ecosystem, would actually help boost Europe in terms of, you know, having standardization of legals, having standardization of incorporation, having, you know, instruments like, you know, you have the YC Safe now, which is obviously ubiquitous in the US, but having this sort of, you know, library of instruments that can be used, you know, and everyone knows that, okay, if I invest in a company in Europe using the EU Safe, for argument's sake, that I can just sign it blind because I know it has, you know, it will form, you know, it'll have exactly the same implications, whether that startup is based in Germany, Spain, Italy, or, you know, for that matter, Turkey or elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So I'm thinking, like, you know, entrepreneurship always existed pre-EU, you know, pre-US being, like, you know, the lead with Silicon Valley, and entrepreneurs have always figured it out somehow to grow the business, attract money. Investors also somehow have always figured out how to invest in the right people.
Yeah, as long as no one is investing. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So from that perspective, I'd say, you know, I think the strength of entrepreneurship lies exactly in the fact to overcome all of those challenges. Now, obviously, you know, if you are able to remove some of that friction, the better it would be. And, you know, in particular in Germany, I feel like this notary system, you know, is very antiquated, is really not helpful. But you could probably, you know, make up a point to 20 points that
are not great in the system, and so where to start. I think if there were some more efforts being made to harmonize the EU startup ecosystem, I think that would be great. You know, recently in Germany, they were they made quite significant changes to the types of employee stock option plans and how the taxation works in that case, which is amazing. And I wish that would happen more often. And
I mean, to the contrary, in Norway, they've kind of almost taken a dagger and just shoved it in the heart of startups by implementing this exit tax, which is like 30% of the paper value of your gains, right? Which is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I would be a big advocate for making it a lot easier for entrepreneurs to build businesses, because I think it's a huge opportunity for value creation.
Yes.
So, yeah, for me, it would be a no-brainer to say, you know, if there were easy ways to scrap some bureaucracy, red tape, make documentation and documents easier, yeah, obviously, it would be amazing.
Yeah.
and it would facilitate, you know, a lot more people moving into entrepreneurship.
And then I guess part of like what Andreas talks about, not to just talk about that, but this actually struck me as being really true, is that Europeans have started believing the memes that the US kind of ecosystem puts on us. You know, no one ever works in August, people don't work as hard as they do in the US. And then he kind of tackles each of them. He's like, well, actually, if you look at the data, Italians work harder than Americans. You know, Americans like, yes, they work hard, but they also like talking about working hard whilst they're standing in a 30-minute queue to grab a, you know, oatmeal, hazelnut latte or whatever from their local coffee shop, right? But so I guess there is this intrinsic sort of Europeanness about, you know, we enjoy who we are and how we do things. There's also like this negativity about, well, we're not, you know, we're risk averse. And certainly we've had a lot of people on the pod who've taken, to some extent, that line that, you know, there is a risk aversion in Europe in general, UK as well, and what needs to be done to overcome that. But I don't think I've had anyone come on the podcast and say they're not intrinsically, and of course they're all from Europe, so I guess, you know, there is that bias. But you know, in your view, should we be intrinsically just optimistic about the future for Europe, or, you know, do you think it's going to be harder than we think it is?
Yeah. Well, I'm obviously an optimist. I mean, if I weren't, I wouldn't be
investing. You wouldn't be investing.
I wouldn't be investing into Europe. But again, for me, it doesn't have to be either or. You know, I when I'm in Germany, I always see the comparison between, oh, you know, is Munich better than Berlin, or Berlin better than Munich or Hamburg? And, you know, and then I'm in London, and then you hear the comparisons between London and Berlin, and sometimes you hear between London or you, and then you hear London, US, and so, you know, personally,
yeah, we have Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, yet again talking about building, you know, Silicon Valley over here. I'm just like, forget about the Silicon Valley narrative. Like, build the ecosystem into the best ecosystem here.
Exactly.
Or there. Yes. Like, don't try and emulate that. Just, you know, go with your strengths.
And as much as we were as a team opportunistic as entrepreneurs, I guess we are opportunistic in a positive sense as investors. You know, if we get to invest in great teams in Europe, which is our main focus, then amazing, we'll do it. If we get to participate and invest and support something that's coming out of the US, yeah, obviously we'll do it. And so, you know, from that perspective, for us, it doesn't matter. But looking at the history of our investments, I think the track record and what we've been able to do and invest and then also provide in or get in returns, I think was largely based on Europe. Mm-hmm. So I'm very positive and bullish and optimistic about Europe being able to grow even further. Mm-hmm. So I see unused potential. And yeah, maybe Europe needs a little bit more of a consensus. You have different nationalities and different countries and different regulations. But eventually, I think it will work out. So I'm very positive about that.
Okay, well, that's amazing. And I think I would definitely fall into that camp because, again, as you say, if not, why be here? You also have some really quite deep thoughts about entrepreneurship as a lifestyle, especially how emotionally tiring it can be. But you clearly have enjoyed the journey having done it twice. So what advice would you give to founders, given your experience, and how should they approach the entrepreneurial journey, especially if it's their first time and if it's also their first time raising from VCs?
Mm. Yeah, again, it's like, don't listen too much to advice of others. I'm happy to share like how I did it.
Yeah,
and then
sure.
Everybody just needs to make up their mind. I think for me, entrepreneurship was never a job, but it was my life. You know, like I started during my PhD starting to develop software because I enjoyed it, and that turned out to be Mendeley and turned out to be a huge success. So I never really separated between job and non-job, because for me it was not my job, it was what I like to do. And so I always had to think about, how do I organize my life to make that work? And luckily, together with my co-founders at Mendeley as well as Copernio, we shared the same values that we said, you know, it's important that you have a balanced life. When somebody had a period where they weren't feeling well or were sick, you know, don't worry, take your time out. And we made sure that we, you know, had most of the time on the weekend off, in the sense of, you know, we could travel somewhere, sure, visit friends, social relationships with people around us, do exercise, and just have a really balanced lifestyle. Because, you know, as you just said, I think it's such an emotionally exhausting and tiring experience. At the same time, it's really rewarding, but it's very tiring.
Problem is the peaks are really high, yes, but the troughs are really long.
Yes, right? Exactly.
Like you know, most people think of kind of entrepreneur because they read on LinkedIn, Twitter, and it's like, oh, amazing announcement.
Yeah.
What they're not reading is the like 6-12 months exactly, of slog, yeah, that went before that, right? And all, yes, the tears and the pain and the issues and this person, you know, essentially resigning and, you know, investors causing you problems or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think people just don't necessarily get kind of how lonely that can be as well, I guess, right?
Yeah, and that's why I said, like, okay, if you by default treat entrepreneurship as your lifestyle, that is the lifestyle you chose to have, then you need to proactively think about, okay, like, but how do I want that lifestyle to be designed, mm-hmm, right? Like, is it just like sitting in front of the computer 24 hours? I mean, it doesn't sound like a really great lifestyle, you know? And so that's where I'm coming from, is that if you treat entrepreneurship as a lifestyle, you will automatically have to think about, well, okay, how do I design my life so that this works? You know, where do I fit in once in a while going to the theater or seeing my friends or doing, you know, sports, playing sports? And that is my recommendation. You know, if you're an entrepreneur, I think it will be your lifestyle. Mm. And if you treat it as such, I think you'll set up yourself for success.
Yeah. I mean, look, I you know, just this weekend, I think it was in 2 days worth of meetings, and I got out minutes on a Sunday afternoon and this sort of stuff. You know, I don't see that as, to your point, it's not work. It's just stuff that needs to be done. The thing is, though, equally, you know, on a Monday, if I want to take 2 hours out of my day and just do something else, I also have the ability to, yes, do that, because, again, as an entrepreneur, you are in charge of your time. Now, I think with one big caveat, when you take on VC investment, you know, you are on a path, you are going to be driven in a certain direction. Yes, they're not going to, you know, VCs are not going to come into your office and say, why aren't you sitting at your desk? But you need to make, I think the point is, you've got to flip your mindset from time-driven goals to output-driven goals, yes, right? To make sure that you are achieving what needs to be achieved in whatever time it takes. So that, you know, that takes you away from kind of clock watching and 9-to-5-ism to get it done, right? Yeah. Like, it doesn't matter if I get it done. Like, if my deadline is here and I get it done because I spent 2 hours doing a 24-hour just like hackathon and just, you know, just getting, you know, getting it done, or I took 3 weeks and, you know, just did it in my own time frame.
Yeah.
That's the important thing.
I think the VC money puts you on a very particular path dependency, where it's very hard to change direction. You know, and whilst obviously you have more comfort because you have more money and you can maybe achieve your goals more easily and possibly faster, but you're a lot more, let's say, on that particular path. Mm. Whilst without VC money, well, you're probably, you know, financially suffering more because obviously you don't have that liquidity and don't have the resources, but you probably have a lot more flexibility. So
yeah,
that needs to be thought through.
Yes. Yeah, it's always a challenge, bootstrap versus taking investment. I mean, it's, you know, having done both, not from VC, but certainly having raised in one business and bootstrapped another, like, I prefer bootstrapping. Yeah. I think, yeah, you know, I realize, I mean, I'm 45 and I think I've said it on the pod before, I realize that I'm just not interested in being beholden and, you know, yes, I want to build a great business and a big business, but I don't necessarily care about building a $1 billion business. Right.
Yeah.
I think that is really good advice, in the sense that, you know, you've got to design your life around how you want to live your life. And I think that's the other thing that people don't necessarily think about, is that a lot of founders, when they take VC money, they end up being miserable, mm-hmm, because they didn't think through the implications of what it means, right? Yeah. So I think you've got to really think through whether it is right for you, not just right for your business, but right for you as an individual. And let's not forget, it doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen. You know, if you take VC money, there's no guarantee you're going to be sat at the desk as a CEO, because, you know, ultimately investors are looking for an exit. They are looking for, you know, the success, whether that's a fund return or whether that is, you know, a 10X or a 50X return, whatever it might be. But if you're not the right person, you know, they will protect their interests to that extent. So I think you've always got to be conscious of all of that. So finally, what is one thing that you have a truly contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, social, or at home? What is the hill that you would die on defending?
Well, I think there's one thing that that I started to be a bit annoyed with in the VC industry, I must say, which I'm trying to, let's say, move a bit against. I'm not sure how contrarian it is in the end, but nevertheless, it's really that. And also, this was a blog post that I did, a post on LinkedIn, is that, you know, you hear that you should only talk to the partners at VC funds. And, you know, we're really not trying to be like that because at 10X Funders, we're really trying to empower everyone in the team because, again, like we're trying to be a team, empowering everyone to share in the decisions. And, you know, in our case, the team can drive this very, very, very far. And, when I hear only talk to the partners, in our case, it just wouldn't work because, you know, there is so limited time.
Bandwidth, time.
So, you know, we have the team to enable the founders to be able to talk more with us and we take our team seriously. So it shows a little bit of, I don't know, maybe a disrespect also for the qualities of the people that work at VCs if somebody holds that preconception.
Yeah, I think it's also this sort of... This idea that VC is very gate-kept, right? Yeah. So actually, you know, the analyst doesn't make the decision. You should only talk to the partner. But if you've only got a half an hour with a partner, they're going to make a decision. They're going to have to love you to make that decision.
Yes. Whereas it's not going to happen often like this.
If you talk to the analyst and then, you know, from there, the investor, and then that goes up to partners and IC, then you can get buy-in from a larger kind of cohort.
I mean, I guess there will be venture funds where it's more like this, right? And you
smaller
even have venture
funds.
Or you have venture funds where there's actually only partners, right?
Yeah.
There is no other team. So fine. but again, I think my view then would be from a founder, you have to figure out like how does the fund work, but do not discredit the team, I think. And it's the same again, like we're trying to set an example by empowering the team also internally to drive these decisions. Almost until the end.
Yeah.
Change that perception a little bit.
Yeah, I think also, I mean, I think that's really great advice because I think the other thing that people don't necessarily think about is that analyst in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, might be partner, right?
Exactly.
If not at that fund, in their own fund or another fund or whatever it is. And do you really want to burn that bridge early doors? Because the thing, whether or not VC is gatekept, it is a relationship game.
Yes.
Partners, you know, when a fund invests, it's the partner that's investing. If that partner moves on to another fund, you hold the relationship with the partner as much as you do with the fund, right?
Yes.
So I think you have to be really, really clear in your head about how, and I'm someone that is very relationship driven. I will never burn a relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, unless something goes completely and utterly toxic, but I will never burn a relationship because I think life is too short.
Absolutely.
And you never, ever really appreciate where someone might come back into your life in the future and be really a force driver for something
and
positive.
Also, like, I guess by default, everybody has positive intentions when you interact with someone else, right? It's like, you know, I'm not looking to interact with you because like I want something bad or negative. And so with that attitude, I think if you know what you just described, I think there's a very good basis for relationships.
Absolutely. Yeah, and look, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast with me today. For our audience at home or our listeners, where can they find you online? You're on LinkedIn, Twitter. Where's the best place for them to find you on the internet?
Yeah, probably on LinkedIn.
Okay, amazing. Jan, once again, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.